yesterday with the arrest of Jesus, Mark 14. There's an interesting little detail in verses 51 and 52 of Mark 14 with which we can begin, I think. A young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth about his body, and they seized him, but he left the linen cloth and ran away naked. Most everyone thinks that it's the author's signature. It says, in a sense, he was there. It's a detail that identifies him as one of the people who ran away. The verse 50 says, all the disciples forsook him and fled. They weren't ready to go with him. And then the author, in this case presumably Mark, also tells about his own forsaking. He doesn't just hide himself in the anonymity of the disciples who ran. He says, I ran too. All right, beginning with verse 53, the trial. In one sense at least, Jesus has, Jesus experienced two trials. One was a religious trial and one was a political trial. The religious trial is described beginning with verse 53, but this was more in the nature of a hearing. Legally, the Sanhedrin could not convene to do its business, that is, to conduct official business during the night. It could only convene to do official business from sun up to sundown while there was daylight. So what went on in the middle of the night was the verdict, which was not officially carried out until daylight. If we read it that way, we can understand what's going on. They led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes were assembled, and Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. And he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. There's a provision in Deuteronomy that the testimony of one witness unsubstantiated is not sufficient for a condemnation. So although there were many witnesses against him, their witness did not agree. Some stood up and bore false witness, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands. Yet not even so did their testimony agree. The high priest finally stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you? But he was silent, said nothing. Again the high priest asked him, are you the Christ, the Messiah, that is, the coming King, the Son of the Blessed? Jesus said, I am, flat out. And you will see the Son of Man, a messianic title, sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. Strange word for a condemned person to be saying. There he is, totally powerless, and confronting them nevertheless with a claim to power. The high priest tore his mantle. This was a ritual action. Judges sometimes would, when they came to pronounce sentence, would put on a black cap if the sentence was death. This instance, the tearing of the garment was a ritual action designed to indicate now the heavy word is coming. They always, by this time, tore their garments in a place where they could be easily mended. little detail. The high priest tore his mantle and said, why do we still need witnesses? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision? And they all condemned him as deserving death. And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to strike him, saying to him, prophesy. That is, who hit you now that you are blind? And the guards received him with blows. As Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the maids of the high priest came, and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, "You also were with the Nazarene, Jesus." But he denied it, saying, "I neither know nor understand what you mean." And he went out into the gateway. And the maid saw him and began again to say to the bystanders, "This man is one of them." But again he denied it. And after a little while again the bystanders said to Peter, "Certainly you are one of them. You are a Galilean." But he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, "I do not know this man of whom you speak." And immediately the cock crowed a second time. And Peter remembered how Jesus had said to him, "Before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times." And he broke down and wept. As soon as it was morning, the chief priests and the elders and the scribes and the whole council held a consultation. This is now the beginning of the official religious trial. What had happened up to this point was unofficial. The verdict had been decided, but now we had to make it legal, you see. And so the Mark's cryptic statement here, "they held a consultation," simply indicates that now the official verdict will be passed. The verdict against Jesus was blasphemy. He claimed to be the anointed one, the Messiah, and he was not, could not be, could not possibly be. But the Sanhedrin could not pronounce a death sentence, and the charge of blasphemy was not one for which the Romans would be willing to execute a man. So Jesus, when he was taken to Pilate, had to be accused not of an ecclesiastical or a religious offense, blasphemy, but of a civil offense, a political offense. Now, Mark does not give us any indication, but Pilate's question, Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" indicates the nature of the charge. This man is in fact promoting treason, insurrection. He claims to be the king when, of course, he is not. So Pilate says to him, "Are you the king of Jews?" And Jesus says, "That's your designation. You have said this." The chief priests accused him of many things, and Pilate again asked him, "Have you no answer to make? See how many charges they bring against you." But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate wondered. Pilate was amazed. Pilate is now really a man in a bind. His position is already weak in relationship to Rome. He had apparently angered the Jews by diverting temple monies to the construction of an aqueduct, and had actually precipitated some riots. He was, in short, somebody who could not really be counted on to keep the provinces in check. That is, he had, I suppose, potential enemies who could accuse him, and so, in a sense, the Jews had him at their mercy. It seems that Pilate really thought Jesus was not guilty of any civil crimes at all, but his own position was weakened to the point where he could not act in a way that would really guarantee some justice in this instance. But he hits on a plan. At the feast, he was accustomed to release for them one prisoner whom they asked. And among the rebels in prison who had committed murder and insurrection, possibly a zealot, probably a terrorist, there was a man called Barabbas. And the crowd came up and began to ask Pilate to do what he was wont to do for them. And he answered them, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" For he perceived that it was out of envy that the chief priests had delivered him up. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have him release for them Barabbas instead. And Pilate again said to them, "Then what shall I do with the man whom you call the king of the Jews?" And they cried out, "Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Crucify him!" So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released for them Barabbas, and having scourged Jesus, he delivered him up to be crucified. It's almost not even necessary, I think, to comment on the misuse of authority. Somebody said about this that if you fear God, you really don't have to fear anything else. But if you don't fear God, you have to be afraid of everything else. Pilate really was afraid of everything else, afraid of losing his job, afraid of the accusations that could be made against him, afraid of his own weakened political position, desperate to hang on to his position, and therefore willing to look the other way in a situation that called for him to act with a certain amount of courage. It's a kind of commentary on political leaders, political leadership, that seeks wrong ends, wrong goals, and therefore lends itself, that political leadership lends itself to injustice. The soldiers led him away inside the palace, that is, to the praetorium. And they called together the whole battalion, and they clothed him in a purple cloak, and plaiting a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they struck his head with a reed and spat upon him and knelt down in homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put on his own clothes and led him out to crucify him. Gregory Dix, Anglican monk, wrote in a little book on the passion narrative that the reaction of the soldiers at this point is in some sense the reaction of men who have been through a period of terrible anxiety and are now finding a kind of release from that anxiety in the kind of thing that they do from Jesus. We don't know if this is actually the case, but it's an interesting conjecture at any rate. Dick says that that Jesus' entry into Jerusalem really was the final temptation, that is, the temptation to all the kingdoms of this world. That here Jesus had the crowd on his side, there was a modest garrison in the city, having inflamed the multitude and the mob, he could have had a kind of storming of the fortress, and the revolution would have been on. These soldiers would have been the first victims of any kind of mob violence, and Dick says they probably all would have had their throats cut. Now the tension is over. The spark that could have ignited the multitude on Palm Sunday or on any time during that week was at last in their hands. And so as a kind of release from that terrible tension, that oppressive possibility of losing their own lives there in this godforsaken part of the empire, they at last have this man in their own hands, and so they mock him. They dress him up in a travesty of royal robes, a crown of thorns, a purple cloak. They beat him, they spit on him. They have sport. This is a way to relieve maybe some of the boredom of being stationed in a garrison town a long way from home. They compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, an interesting little detail which perhaps indicates that these people were now participants of the Christian community. They compelled Simon of Cyrene to carry the cross. Actually, the whole cross was probably not carried, but simply a beam. I don't know how many of you saw the television account of Jesus. When was it? A year and a half ago or so on television. I think it was the one that General Motors didn't want to sponsor. Jesus too controversial for General Motors. That was marvelous. At any rate, the site of execution outside of the city was actually a sort of scaffolding. We have this picture, you know, of three crosses raised up outside of the city. It may not have been like that at all. It may have been a kind of wooden scaffolding out there on which executed people were simply hung as needed. So what he carried was probably simply the cross beam. He was already, however, too weak to do that because crucifixion was almost always preceded by scourging, flogging, which left the condemned person in a terribly weak state. They brought him to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of a skull. And they offered him wine mingled with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads, saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself, come down from the cross." So also the chief priests mocked him to one another with the scribes, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." And those who were crucified with him also reviled him. I have a book by Martin Hengel that Fortress Press has just published. It's not very long, 100 or so pages, entitled Crucifixion. I want to read the summary that Hengel has here. But what he does is to begin with the statement of Paul's in 1 Corinthians 1:18. That the word of the cross is folly, a stumbling block for the Jews, folly for the Gentiles. Justin Martyr, Hengel quotes, says, "They say that our madness, our mania, consists in the fact that we put a crucified man in second place after the unchangeable and eternal God, the creator of the world." What distinguished Christianity from all other religions was that, as the Roman historian Pliny writes, they worship a Christ who was crucified, an impossibility. I'll explain why in a moment. It was madness, it was folly, it was an offense, because crucifixion was the most detestable form of execution. To worship a God who was crucified is the worst folly of all. Hengel quotes Minucius Felix, "To say that their ceremonies center on a man put to death for his crime on the fatal wood of the cross is to assign to these abandoned wretches sanctuaries which are appropriate to them and the kind of worship they deserve." It was stupidity. It was folly. He's got other quotations here. This one that Augustine quotes, an oracle from Apollo about a man who wanted to know what he could do to dissuade his wife from Christian belief. "Let her continue as she pleases, persisting in her vain delusions, lamenting in song a God who died in delusions, who was condemned by judges whose verdict was just, and executed in the prime of life by the worst of deaths, a death bound with iron." He had to endure being fastened to a cross with iron nails. Yet that is the heart of the Christian message. Hengel's summary, let me just read his summary points. Crucifixion as a penalty was remarkably widespread in antiquity. It appears, he says, even among the Greeks, who were among the more humane of the peoples in the ancient world. Crucifixion, secondly, was and remained a political and military punishment. Among the Persians, it was imposed primarily on high officials, on commanders who were guilty of treason. But among the Romans, for centuries, he has, I can't quote all of this, but he has a lot of quotations from Cicero, from Romans throughout the 4 centuries or so before and after the event of the crucifixion. Among the Romans, it was inflicted on slaves, on violent criminals, on unruly elements in the rebellious provinces, not least in Judea. The mere threat of crucifixion was sufficient to enable one or to cause one Jewish garrison in the rebellion sometime later to surrender. Titus crucified as many as 500 people a day trying to slip out of Jerusalem as a way of trying to get the city to surrender. The chief reason for its use, and this is the third point, was that it was an allegedly supreme deterrent. It was carried out publicly. It satisfied the primitive lust for revenge and the sadistic cruelty of individual rulers and of the masses. And when a prisoner was delivered to troops to be executed, they could do anything. They crucified people in grotesque ways. It was thus a specific expression of the inhumanity of which human beings are capable. By the public display of a naked victim in a prominent place, you know, our pictures of this are already heavily overlaid with piety. It's impossible for us, I think, to conceive of not only the grotesque, but also the humiliating character of this. For the victim was simply crucified naked and was able to be tortured to death for days. You could actually hang there for days, dying of dehydration and exposure rather than of your wounds, at modest public expense, Hengel says. Didn't cost him very much to do this. And hanging there at a crossroads, in a theater, on high ground, at the place of the crime, where people would be continually walking by and where you would be humiliated in front of them, crucifixion represented the uttermost humiliation of the individual. Hengel also says we rarely have in the ancient world any such a detailed description as the one we have in the Gospels. That's exactly what's going on. Anybody who walked by could mock or humiliate the person who was there. You who claim to be the king of the Jews, save yourself, come down from the cross. All of the taunts, all of the shouts. Crucifixion was aggravated further by the fact that its victims quite often were never buried. One of my colleagues says that frequently people wonder about the historicity of the resurrection. We ought to move back a little bit and wonder about the historicity of the burial of Jesus. Because the evidence seems to indicate that the victims were frequently denied the one dignity to be accorded a corpse. It was a stereotype picture that the crucified victim often served as food for wild beasts and birds of prey, scavengers. In this way, his humiliation was complete. What it meant for a man in antiquity to be refused burial and the dishonor that went with it can hardly be appreciated by us. In Roman times, again, crucifixion was practiced above all on dangerous criminals and members of the lowest classes, the slaves, that is, groups whose development had to be suppressed by all possible means to safeguard law and order in the state. There were relatively few attempts at criticism or even at a philosophical development of the theme of the boundless suffering of countless victims of crucifixion. In this context, then, the Christian message of the crucified Messiah demonstrates the solidarity of the love of God with the unspeakable suffering of those who experienced the worst kind of death. In the person and fate of this one Jesus of Nazareth, the saving solidarity of God with us is given its historical and physical form, so that when St. Paul says in Philippians 2 that he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even death on the cross, that is the ultimate in humiliation. He died the slave's death. He came as one who was our doulos, our slave, and died a slave's death, given up to public shame, experiencing the full curse of the law. I want to say more about that in a moment. And yet, it is the Christian proclamation that in this humiliation, in this slave's death, is life. God, who did not spare his own Son, but gave him up for us all, will he not also with us, with him, give us all things? The cross, says Hengel, and this is his summary, is more than a religious symbol for the uttermost readiness of human beings for suffering and sacrifice, although it is that. It is more than an ethical model which calls for discipleship, though it is that as well, Hengel says. What we have here, finally, is God's communication of himself, the utterly free action through which he establishes the effective basis of our salvation. Mark doesn't reflect on that, but we need to. I will in a moment. Let me finish the reading. When the sixth hour had come, there was a darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? And some of the bystanders, hearing it, said, behold, he is calling Elijah. And one ran and filled a sponge full of vinegar and put it on a reed and gave him to drink, saying, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come and take him down. Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that he thus breathed his last, he said, truly, this man was a son of God. Takes a Gentile again to bear testimony. The disciples still do not understand. I think it's difficult for us, you know, with centuries of piety overlaying this event, to understand fully the kind of scandal, the kind of offense that it was, to link together the royal reign of God with this miserable crucified victim. Yet that is precisely the Christian good news. In a sense, God taking his own medicine, God subjecting himself to the radical evil of which his own fallen creatures are capable, and in that way affecting their own salvation. Herb Brokering has a little parable in Eye Openers that says something about what we have done. He says, once there was a church that decided not to put a cross in their church. The building committee told them that they could save $100 that way. Instead, they have learned, he says, to make the sign of the cross over bread and wine and water and over each other. And now, instead of one cross, they have hundreds of them. I don't know when Christians began to use the sign of the cross as a symbol. It was not their earliest symbol. The earliest symbol that we know was a fish, perhaps. The cross was almost too shameful for them to make into a symbol. It may well be that it was only when crucifixion ceased to be a punishment that it was possible for the Christian community to have even the little courage that it then took to make it a symbol. it's hard for us to imagine what it means to have the cross as a symbol. I've often wondered, you know, what we would think if we walked into our churches and instead of finding a cross there on the altar, we would find an electric chair or a model of a gas chamber or a guillotine, contemporary methods of execution. Maybe we can get some sense of this from both the meaning and the scandal of it, from this now almost classic description of an execution from Elia Wiesel's book Night, his description of his teenage years in a German concentration camp. One day when we came back from work, we saw three gallows rearing up in the assembly place, three black crows. Roll call, SS all around us, machine guns trained. One day when we came back from work, we saw three gallows rearing up in the assembly place, three black crows. Roll call, SS all around us, machine guns trained, the traditional ceremony, three victims in chains, and one of them, the little servant, the sad-eyed angel. They had discovered a plot in which a power station at Buna had been blown up, and the trail, he said, led to the Dutch Oberkapo in the concentration camp where they found an important stock of arms, and this little boy had been the Oberkapo's servant. The SS seemed more preoccupied, more disturbed than usual. To hang a young boy in front of thousands of spectators was no light matter. The head of the camp read the verdict, all eyes on the child. He was lividly pale, calm, biting his lips. The gallows threw its shadow over him. This time the lager couple refused to act as executioner. Three SS replaced him. The three victims mounted together onto the chairs. The three necks were placed at the same moment within the nooses. Long live liberty, cried the two adults, but the child was silent. Where is God? Where is he? Someone behind me asked. At a sign from the head of the camp, the three chairs tipped over. Total silence throughout the camp. On the horizon, the sun was setting. Bare your heads, yelled the head of the camp. His voice was raucous. We were weeping. Cover your heads! And then the march past began, the two adults no longer alive. But the third rope was still moving. Being so light, the child was still alive. For more than half an hour he stayed there, struggling between life and death, dying in slow agony under our eyes, and we had to look him full in the face as we marched past. Behind me I heard the same man asking, "Where is God now?" And I heard a voice within me answering him, "Where is he? Here he is. He is hanging there on this gallows." That night the soup tasted of corpses. I think it might be difficult for us to identify ourselves with this humiliation if we understood the character of it. And that was what was really shocking to the early Christian community. They did not finally think that God's anointed, God's Messiah, the son of David, the royal descendant who was to restore the kingdom, who was to bring glory to Israel, would experience this kind of humiliating death. And that then really remains the question. As Jesus dies, it is an open question. Is he really what he claims to be? Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? I am, he says. Are you the Christ if you are on the cross? Can't possibly be. And the death is the final demonstration that he is really not God's Christ at all. His life ends with this kind of open question. Was he the bearer of the redemptive reign of God? And was his way God's way? Or was he really the lawless one, deserving of this kind of penalty for his blasphemy or his disobedience? The resurrection says yes to that question. And thus, Jesus, in his death, overcomes the tyranny of the law and the tyranny, the necessity to sin. What this means is that he has not so much overcome the tyranny of Torah, that whole collection of legislation by which the Jews were identified among the nations, but rather that law that governs the structures of the world, the law by which people seek to live and to defend themselves from chaos, from darkness, from evil. You know, all of the structures that we have built to protect ourselves, in a sense, from each other, the locks on the doors, the systems of government. I guess it was Reinhold Niebuhr who pointed out that the American Revolution devised a system of government designed not so much as a tribute to our ability to govern ourselves, but as a way to protect ourselves from each other. Nobody shall have absolute power over anyone else. When I was a high school student, I was in the American Legion oratory contest, and I wrote a speech on the foundation of American freedom, the writ of habeas corpus. That is, the inability of even our police and our courts to keep us in prison without a charge that can be tried in a court of law for a very long time. I didn't win the contest. The Legion wasn't too interested in the writ of habeas corpus. But I found it to be a fascinating experience. Partly because if we ask about the foundation of our country, it's not some high and lofty rhetoric and some great sense of really our ability to govern ourselves, but a whole series of structures designed to protect us from what we are able to do to each other. We do not even have the rule of majority, except in things that may not matter all that much. On the things that really count, what is at the foundation of our system is the protection of the rights of minorities. All of us are minorities in one way or another, and therefore if we do not defend the rights of minorities, we are ourselves going to be the victims at some point. So these structures are not tributes to our greatness and our genius, but really to the potential evil and cruelty of which all of us are capable. That is the law. We try to defend ourselves, and by doing it, we actually increase our sin, for that is what the law always does. It makes us more sinners. We, rather than trusting God, we begin to trust the structures by which we have tried to protect ourselves from evil and chaos, and then actually spread worse evil. Build huge defense establishments only to have weapons that can evaporate the planet. Destroy the city to save it was one of the phrases that came out of the Vietnam War. But now, if Jesus' way really is God's way, if his giving of himself in total and unconditioned commitment to us is really God's way, then he can break the power of those systems over us. By loving us at our worst, he can make it possible for us now to trust that love in such a way that we do not need our defenses, that we are free to be vulnerable, free to be sinners, free even to confess and look at some of the worst of the motives from which we act. Somebody from California was here just talking about Proposition 13, and that the real animus behind that, for many people, he says, as revealed, or he told me, as revealed in the letters to the editor now, the real animus behind that was that we want to put a stop to welfare cheating and aid to the poor and the oppressed aspects of our society. And we didn't mean for it to cut police protection and fire protection. But in the campaign, of course, those kinds of things couldn't be admitted. We find all kinds of ways to protect ourselves, to deceive ourselves from the real motives on the basis of which we act and function in the political world. If Jesus really is God's unconditioned commitment to us, if he can know all about us, the worst there is about us, and love us anyway, then we too can look at ourselves honestly. That's what the cross makes confession possible. It means I don't have to tell lies about myself any longer. I really am free to confess. If he can love those who are his enemies, then we, when we experience that love, are also free to break the bondage of retribution and defense, and to love our enemies, to forgive them. And in a moving passage, Jürgen Moltmann also talks about liberation from God-forsakenness. The handing over, the parodidomy, the handing over, which Paul talks about in Romans 1, therefore God handed them over to their sins. That handing over, that abandoning, shows itself, as it were, in God's silence at our self-glorification and at his permitting the murderous and the suicidal consequences which stem from our human self-glorification. That's the manifestation of God's wrath. In his abandonment by God, in his God-forsakenness, the Son of God takes upon himself both the fate of the man who has been handed over and the wrath of God. In the light of his message about the impending kingdom, this abandonment on the cross is the end of Jesus' mission. But in the light of his resurrection, we have to say with Paul that through his forsakenness, Jesus has brought God to the God forsaken. The Father did not spare his own Son, but gave him up for us all, in order that through him he might be the father of the forsaken, the God of the godless, the refuge of those who are without hope. That's what is happening here, and that is what we have then made the central symbol of the Christian church. There were also women looking on from afar, among whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the younger, and of Joses and Salome, who when he was in Galilee followed him and ministered to him, and also many other women who came up with him to Jerusalem. And when evening had come, since it was the day of preparation, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, a respected member of the council, who was also himself looking for the kingdom of God, took courage and went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. And Pilate wondered if he were already dead, and summoning the centurion, asked him whether he was already dead. And when he had learned from the centurion that he was dead, he granted the body to Joseph. And he brought a linen shroud, and taking him down, wrapped him in the linen shroud, and laid him in a tomb which had been hewn out of the rock. And he rolled a stone against the door of the tomb. And Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of Joses saw where he was laid. Well, we have only one section left, the last chapter, Mark 16, 1-8. We'll do that tomorrow.